Hey friends, welcome back to the Bad Yogi Podcast. Today's episode is one I thought I'd literally never do. I am interviewing a life coach. I know. Save your eye rolls. I mean, I really had to resist the urge to not roll my eyes at myself when I decided to do this. But here's my thought process. As I was looking for interesting people to talk to, I came across this guy named Jator Pierre, who was actually recommended to me from JP Sears. If you remember, he was on several episodes ago, super cool guy. So already that's one level of skepticism removed. But anyway, back to my thought process. Lately, I've been thinking that maybe some of the things I roll my eyes at are actually some of the things I need to hear, or at least need to be open to hearing. And I think that's the case with a lot of us too. The stuff we passionately reject or just shy away from are exactly the things we need to be open to. So back to Jator, when JP told me about this guy, I thought, okay, let me just check it out. And first thing I see on Jator's website is that he is not a, quote, life coach. And I had to laugh because I'm like, a life coach who doesn't consider himself a life coach. All right, how annoying could he possibly be? It turns out, not super annoying. So I'm talking with Jator about so many things today. Jator Pierre has been in the process of transforming lives since 1999. Using a vast toolbox of modalities to bring out lasting change in his clients, his work in emotional trauma and chronic stress is really on display in our talk today. He's super passionate about seeing the bigger picture and how that trickles down to underlying mechanisms which lead to all kinds of imbalance in our lives, both physical and emotional. His purpose is to help people examine and understand not only how the body functions, but how each physical symptom can correlate to and is expressive of underlying mental, emotional, and behavioral patterns. So super interesting stuff. Jator works globally through Skype and currently lives in Copenhagen, Denmark, after moving just a few weeks ago on pure gut instinct. And actually, that was one of the first things that he told me when I introduced myself via email, was that he was based in San Francisco and he was like, well, I just moved to Denmark on literally just my gut instinct. And I thought, okie dokie, let's see where this conversation goes. So I don't know. Are you intrigued? I definitely was. And that's, you know, I'm just going to leave it at that. That's plenty from me. I am going to let Jator take it from here.
Jator Pierre, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I really appreciate it. I'm going to hit you with a softball question right off the bat. I've got to know how you start your morning, but not the aspirational answer, like the real life answer.
I love that. I love that you said not the aspirational answer, because honestly, I don't ever start my morning with some aspirational answer or gratitude or any of those other things.
Or like lemon water.
I start my morning, most mornings, thinking, wow, I'm here again. And what challenges, what surprises, and what's in store for me today? And typically, to be extremely honest, my very first thought in the morning is, I'm ready for my cup of coffee. So sometimes, in all honesty, I'll wake up at 5 a.m. and I could probably sleep for another 2 hours, but the thought of coffee jumps into my mind, and that will literally be enough to get me out of bed. And I'll say, fuck it, and go make a cup of coffee, even though I probably need another 2 hours of sleep. But because I love coffee so much and what it represents to me, I will get out of bed to make coffee. So that is my non-aspirational answer, is coffee gets me out of bed in the morning.
Hashtag relatable. I love coffee too. And it's, I love the taste of coffee, but it's also the ritual. So I totally get what you're saying. It's like the, I have an espresso machine, but I also have a French press, and it's just the ritual, the smell, and depending on the weather, just, I don't know. I'm with you. Coffee is just, it just makes the morning better.
What I appreciate about what you shared is that ritualistic aspect, and something that has come to my life as why I drink coffee is, yeah, there's the ritual, but there's also the what coffee actually represents to me from an emotional perspective. And I grew up in a Cuban and Burmese household. So I've been drinking coffee since I was probably two. I think I got coffee before I got breast milk. And what actually gets me up in the morning isn't the caffeine, or I don't even think it's the actual ritual. What gets me up in the morning is that every Saturday, my family, when I was a child, would get together and we'd have café con leche and these other kind of Cuban dishes. And that's what I'm actually after in the morning. I'm after that. What my family represented to me was safety and security and support and closeness and understanding. And so that cup of coffee and the warmth of coffee actually represents my family to me. And that's really important to my heart. And I think that's why I love coffee so much. It's not coffee itself. It's what's in that cup of coffee is my family that I get to drink every morning and connect to every morning, which helps me have the courage to get through my day.
Absolutely. Well, that makes sense. We have that with so many different things, I think, whether it's a smell or a taste or a place. I think a lot of us have a connection to some kind of nostalgia through one of our senses. Mm. Now, on your website, you actually have in very large letters, "I am not a life coach." And I thought this was curious because according to like everything else on your website, I'm like, oh, okay, this guy's a life coach. So when I got to that, I had to rethink some things. Mm. And I wanted to just clear the air because I think there's, and maybe this is your intention too, but I think there's a stigma that comes with the title life coach that kind of makes people roll their eyes, you know? Mm. And so what is the difference between a quote unquote life coach and you, what you do?
I appreciate that question. Well, I think the reason why I put that on my website is because in my experience, life coaches, health coaches, coaches in general, many coaches take the perspective, and I'm not saying this is right or wrong, that they're the expert and they're in charge and they're leading the client. So what I meant by that statement is that's not my approach to coaching at all. My approach to coaching is very synergistic in the sense of I'm there as a support and as a person to ask questions. I ask questions to help clients find their own answers, their own way of doing things, and their own truths. Because when you look at coaching right now, there's basically two different models out there. There's the expert model or the collaborative model. And for me, the collaborative model is really important, which takes me out of the seat of the expert and puts me in the seat right next to my client. I have struggles too. I have fears too. I have shame too. I have blocks too. I am a human being that is navigating life the best way I can on a daily basis and trying to learn. So by saying I'm not a life coach, I'm basically giving voice to, I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'm here to ask questions, thoughtful questions that help you reflect on what you're doing so that you can find different ways of doing that for yourself, or you can continue to make the decision that you're currently making, even if that feels like it's not serving you. It's not my job to push you in any direction. It's not my job to say what is serving you or not serving you in your life. It's my job to allow you the space to find those answers for yourself. You know, if a coaching session with me is typically about 80% client talking, 20% me asking questions, not me giving guidance, not me offering opinion, not me pushing my agenda. And that feels really different for me. And it feels not life coachy. It feels like a support mechanism. Someone to bounce ideas off of for themselves to find their own direction. And I think, you know, we look at life coaching or coaching, most coaches, and I'm being a little arrogant and self-righteous in the moment, so just take that as a grain of salt. So I'm not being critical. I want to be clear about that. Just different than what I do. Come to a coaching session with an agenda or a subconscious need for their client to change. And if you come to a coaching session with an agenda or subconscious need for your client to change, what you're doing, in my opinion, is you're creating a codependent relationship and a parent-child relationship with your client. My job, from my perspective, is not to become your parent. My job is to become your brother or sister and to help you become your own parent and understand the consequences of choice and decision in your life. So for me, it's a very different way of coaching. And that's why I'm not a life coach.
I love it. I think that makes sense. I've never heard it expressed that way before. And it kind of sounds like, and I know these roles are different, but it kind of sounds like what a good therapist should be, which is not someone who's going to sit there and tell you, here's everything you need to do. Oh, you're having a problem with your mom? Here's what you need to do. But empower you to figure out a solution that's going to work best. I'm going to borrow some words from our community. I put out to our community before our chat, like, hey, I'm talking to a non-annoying life coach. What questions would you have?
I'm probably annoying some people already.
You can't win them all, you know?
No, you can't.
What is it about a life coach that is so, or a coach in general, I'm just going to use the term coach as a general thing, that is so essential for some people? Like, why is it that so often we can't seem to reach these conclusions on our own?
Oh, I love that question. Wow, that's pretty profound. So my take on that question would be this. Maybe if we use another situation, it would become more clear. Have you ever noticed how typically we have a hard time when we're emotionally attached or emotionally invested in someone or something else? I.e., it's harder for us to give clean, clear advice because we're emotionally attached to an outcome. I.e., you have a husband, and let's say he asks you a question. Well, what's interesting about your answer is that typically your answer is going to be agenda-driven based on what your needs, values, and perspectives are. Because you have a high emotional attachment to him, that will be slightly convoluted. You with me so far?
Yeah.
Okay. So that would be convoluted toward your agenda and what you want your husband to be subconsciously. Sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So then you take that as an outside relationship. So take that tenfold higher and say, well, who are we probably most emotionally attached to? Well, most of us, in my guess, would be most emotionally attached to ourselves. So that emotional attachment to self and the parts of ourselves creates a lot of blind spots, because it's very hard for us to see outside of our own lenses, because our lenses have been essentially honed since the moment of birth. And depending on who you believe, our lenses could be have honed, you know, in utero or even prior to that, if you're into that perspective. So you're so emotionally attached to yourself that essentially you're like a horse wearing blinders. And it's very hard to give yourself good, clean, clear advice when you're trying to change, because most of that is going to be coming through familiar patterns. It's going to be very hard to see outside of yourself. And this is why, at least in my opinion, a coach or someone that you're paying can be so helpful to that change process, because they're going to be reflecting things back to you without the emotional attachment to you. What do I mean by that? If you are my client, do I care about you as a human being on the planet? Yes, of course I do. I don't know about others, but of course I do. So yeah, I care about that. But let's say you smoke cigarettes and you're trying to stop smoking cigarettes and that go through that behavior change. I actually don't have an agenda whether you smoke cigarettes or not. It's irrelevant to me. If you want to smoke cigarettes, yay. If you don't want to smoke cigarettes, yay. My job then is to help you decipher the positive and negative outcomes of quitting cigarettes, which is really important. What are the positive outcomes that you deem as positive? And interestingly enough, what are the negative outcomes of quitting cigarettes that you would experience? And then on the flip side of that, what are the negative aspects of continuing to smoke cigarettes? And what are the positive aspects of continuing to smoke cigarettes? So you can get a clear perspective on consequence and outcome. And what that essentially is functional parenting. It's functionally parenting self to make decisions from a clearer perspective that are outside your typical angles that you're always looking through. I have a coach that I can reflect things to who can ask me questions from different angles to shine a different light on what's going on in my life so I can see it from outside of myself. And for me, that is the probably the one of the most powerful things of having a coach is they can shine different angles on what's going on in your life for you to make the decision process in terms of what is serving you and what isn't serving you in your life. And who do you want to be? When I say what's serving you or not serving you, I don't mean that from a value perspective, like what's good or bad. I mean that from the perspective of emotionally what's serving you. And who do you want to be today? And who do you want to be moving forward? If that answer comes back, I want to be the same person. I have no agenda to change that. And it's really interesting as a paradox, the agendalessness actually creates a lot of change because we're learning to acknowledge where we're at rather than deny where we're at and say that it's good, bad, right, or wrong. It simply is where we're at.
Yeah, well, I actually really like this this concept of sort of self-parenting because especially as you get older, I'm already veering off track of what I was going to ask you next, but as you get older, I think we all begin to see our parents less as like mom and dad and more as humans who are flawed, who don't have all the answers, who did things that weren't correct in your estimate as you're grown. And so to have this idea that like, oh, maybe you don't always need necessarily to go back in time and rectify that or go back to them and rectify that, but you can actually, like you say, sort of self-parent yourself, self-coach yourself in a more productive, functional way today. I just think it's an interesting perspective. And that's not exactly what you said, but that's sort of how it landed with me and maybe with others too.
Can I draft off of something you'd shared?
Please, yeah.
that I really appreciated. The reparenting of self, I think, is really important. And also noticing something that you said is as we grow, we notice, wow, our parents aren't the superheroes that we thought they were. And what's really cool about that is, can I ask how old you are?
I'm 30.
I'm 30. So that what's really cool about that from my perspective is like, that's your 30-year-old self recognizing that as a 30-year-old. Mom and dad weren't the superheroes that I thought they were. Cool. What's interesting to me about that, though, is all of us, from my perspective, are just children dressed up in these adult suits. And what you're giving voice to, from my perspective, is this adult part of you. Interestingly enough, though, there's lots of other aspects of who you are that are still vibrantly moving inside of you and vibrantly expressing every day and vibrantly you're looking through their lenses on a daily basis, which is really interesting. So there's parts of you that still, my guess is, put your parents up on these pedestals, whether it's through compliance to their values or defiance to their values. And as you're doing that and you're acknowledging as a 30-year-old, you're seeing this perspective, these other parts of you are still attached to seeing your parents in a certain light. And one way to notice how attached we are to our parents' values or who we think our parents are, even if we're 30 years old, 40 years old, 50 years old, 60 years old, a very easy symbol to notice that most of us do, at least in my experience, is the next time your mom or dad is coming to your house to visit, notice yourself. Do you clean your house in a different way? Do you hide certain magazines? Do you hide your bong? Do you hide your real conversations? It is a blatant and beautiful and powerful sign and symbol. The more you change yourself when your parents are coming over is showing you how much attachment your younger children still have to being who they need you to be so you can fit in. And then you ask yourself that question, oh, can I curse on here?
Yeah, of course.
And then you ask that question, shit, okay. If mom and dad are my initial symbols, generally, of who I've learned to contort myself for to fit into their needs because I'm afraid of disappointing them, of hurting them, of not being enough, etc. Who else do I project my parents onto? Oh shit, everyone else. Work, relationships, friends. How many of us, you know, in this world that you're in and I'm in, you know, there's a lot of this talk about being authentic. How many of us hide our authentic self, just like when our parents are coming over and we change or clean or represent things very differently? How many of us hide ourselves and hide that in all of these other relationships? And another symbol of when you're hiding yourself is, when do you feel afraid to say something to someone and you omit that information and then say something maybe a little bit more softer or a little bit more sweeter, or you don't even tell them that truth, you omit it. One way we all hide on a daily basis is through omission of information, which is typically based on we're afraid or we're ashamed, which goes back to our childhood and our experience of ourselves around our parents.
That gets uncomfortable, I think. And I have two follow-up questions. The first one is on that note, okay, your parents are coming over and you fill in the blank, you know, whether it's you clean differently, you hide your bong, you change your conversations. My question is, isn't there some things that you can change according to, like, if your parents are coming over that don't necessarily mean that there's some weirdness going on or some attachment that's unhealthy? It just means that your parents don't have to see everything in the behind the scenes version of your life. Or should we just be like completely filter free in front of anyone and everyone all the time?
I love the question. Yeah. First and foremost, I think what's important is I'm not saying anything is wrong with that behavior of changing your environment for when your parents are coming over. So I think that's first and foremost important. Second is I can't really answer that question. What I can do is say that question can only be answered by you. How do you feel about what you're doing? Does it feel when you're changing your room or your household, are you doing it from a place? Does it feel constricting in your body? Does it feel like you're hiding? How old do you feel when you're actually doing that in your house? Might be another good question.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you're 3 years old all of a sudden and you're preparing for mommy and daddy to come home? That might be a little something to look at. Or do you feel like you're making this decision from a more adult place inside of you? And this isn't kind of rational, I'm going to think about this. I'm using the word feeling really importantly from the perspective of how do you feel in your body when you're doing this? What are the sensations? Do you feel constriction in your chest or in your gut when you think about, am I hiding things? And then the other piece that you brought up for me, which is important, is I may be a little crazy, and I don't think human beings do anything without hidden agendas. So when someone says, well, I'm just cleaning up for my parents, for me, there's a tremendous amount of vibrancy in the word just that is covering up a lot of subconscious behaviors. So many of us, as children, we either become very compliant to our family's values or very defiant to our family's values. And how does that just show up? Just use the word just three times. This is fun. So we take this example of cleaning the house, right? Maybe the compliant child cleans up, compliant adult child cleans up to hide things from their parents, to make sure that their parents still know that they're their good little boy or good little girl still. The defiant child leaves the bong out and is like, whatever, I'm still defiant to you. The trick is, from my perspective, is either one is still an attachment to being who you thought you needed to be to get attention when you were a child from your family, whether you were compliant or defiant. They're both ways that we got attention as children. So how do we move ourselves from a place of getting attention from our parents and learning to respect our parents and not have the need to approve all of their behaviors and values? And through that respect, learn how to find our own value sets and represent ourselves as who we truly are, who we truly feel we authentically are, i.e., let's say my whole family is Democratic and I'm very hardcore Republican. How do I learn to represent that in front of my family respectfully toward myself rather than hiding that? And so do I think we need to be, you know, put it all out there? No. Time and space for everything. What I am saying is, can you and I and everyone else simply question and get curious? Why am I doing what I'm doing? Wow, that's an interesting behavior that I do hide some things when my parents come over. That's curious. I wonder about that. And how does that show up in my other relationships?
Now, let's say you uncover some behaviors or some things that you're hiding that you feel like, ooh, that doesn't feel right. That doesn't feel good. How can we put aside a frustrating or a toxic side of a relationship in order to, as you say, see the child within this person?
Yeah. Well, if you're feeling a sense of being in a toxic relationship for you, for me, what's important about that is to really get clear first and foremost on, this might not be so fun to hear, how are you or I co-creating that toxic environment? Many of us, in my experience, do a lot of projecting, criticizing, blaming, and shaming the other person. That person's toxic. They're doing the wrong thing. And maybe fewer of us question ourselves, how am I facilitating and co-creating this toxic relationship? I'll give you an example from my own life, which probably won't be so great. But in a past relationship I was in, my experience of the woman at times was pretty volatile and angry. And I felt a pretty good amount of blame and shame internally, at least toward her. And then I started to ask this question to myself. Okay, well, that's cool, Jatour. I see how you're trying to deflect from looking at yourself. Awesome. How are you co-creating this? And I was having a very hard time finding that answer because, again, I'm emotionally attached to myself. I'm also emotionally attached to defending myself and proving myself. So it's hard to see. It requires a tremendous amount of vulnerability to see how you are co-creating these dysfunctional relationships. So I come home, I walk into the kitchen, I open the kitchen door, and I do something with something in the fridge, some food stuff, and I put it back, and I put it back in the exact way that I know is going to piss her off. And she's in the room. And I'm watching, I'm observing myself do this, which is fascinating to watch, right? So I'm doing it and I put it back and you know, probably intuitively on some level, I know she's going to walk in, and lo and behold, what happens? She walks in right when I'm doing it at a very subconscious, purposeful level. And then she flies off the handle. And then I get to feel self-righteous and arrogant and say, oh, there she goes again.
Oh, yeah.
And so part of that mirror then became, how do I start to change this dysfunctional relationship? I started to change it through, how am I co-creating it? What is the little boy inside of me that needs to trigger this person so I can get attention? Because maybe I'm not feeling attended to or seen or heard or acknowledged. And going back to my childhood, interestingly enough, I grew up mainly in a single mom household with a mom that was, you know, struggling to make ends meet. And we lived in Oakland, and we lived in a one bedroom apartment, and I lived in the living room, and my mom was stressed and money was tight. And I remember the sense of feeling like, how do I rescue my mom? How do I become enough to make my mom happy? How do I become enough to take my mom's stress away? Interestingly enough, cleaning the house, doing dishes, trying to support her the best I could as a child, and always failing because I can't save my mom. It's not my job. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I'm a kid. And that's a tremendous amount of pressure to put on oneself. And then how did that show up fast forward to this relationship? Fast forward to this relationship, I was trying still, the little boy in me was trying to save my metaphoric mommy. And I had to fail at it. And to continue to get attention as I did as a child, I needed to create situations where I was going to get yelled at or criticized because, interestingly enough, from a child's perspective, any attention is better than no attention. Kids will typically die or really fall apart if they get no attention. And I mean like zero attention. Mm-hmm. Kids will typically do anything to get any attention, whether that's the most heinous things that we think about how kids are treated to the most beautiful things that we think about when kids are treated. I learned as a child that one way to get attention was to be defiant to my mom, which then showed up in my relationships with women. And then we started to think about, well, wow, how many of us are still playing those roles in relationships? How many of us see our partner at times as metaphoric daddy? How many of us see our partner at times as metaphoric mommy? And how many of us start to disconnect from each other as we start to create and turn our partners into our parents? It becomes a very, in my perspective, it becomes very dysfunctional. It becomes very codependent. And it leads to dysfunction and pain in relationships because we're trying essentially to work out our mommy and daddy issues with our partners, because we haven't yet gone inside to address and heal perspective and integrate these past experiences that we've had so that we use our partners now to recapitulate those and kind of re-facilitate our experiences of one or both of our parents. So very long-winded answer. So how do we start to move out of these dysfunctional relationships? My number one go-to would be we have to heal or look at or integrate or consider what are our dysfunctional relationships internally, because those are just simply being then re-expressed externally. Any relationship, in my opinion, that we have external to self is a mirror for a relationship that you have internally with another aspect of who you are.
Good time to introduce you to one of our show sponsors, The Citizenry. Ever since we moved to France, I've tried to choose wisely with the new things that I buy for our home. I try to avoid mass-produced furniture and other decorative things that I don't even care about, but just exist to fill my space. One place I love for high-quality home decor stuff that also tells a story is The Citizenry. They have a huge collection of globally inspired home goods that are gorgeous and functional. They partner with artisans from over a dozen countries to create unique collections from each country. It's all fair trade and leaves a lasting positive impact within each artisan community. Personally, I am obsessed with their pottery for indoor plants and vases for flowers because they give off all the Pinterest living room vibes of my dreams. You know what I mean? So consider this a belated housewarming gift. For your first order, The Citizenry is offering you a $50 gift voucher toward your purchase over $200. Just go to citizenrypodcast.com/yogi today and use promo code YOGI to redeem this offer, which is just for podcast listeners. That's code YOGI at citizenrypodcast.com/yogi for $50 towards your purchase of $200 or more. citizenrypodcast.com/yogi, code YOGI. And back to our show.
Absolutely. I would venture to bet too, like for myself, I was thinking this is, I don't know that I do this with my partner, with my husband, but I definitely do this with my parents, where like I'll do something now as an adult, I'll do something or say something just so that I get the response that I know I'm going to get that's going to piss me off, you know, like I'll leave something out when they come over, or I'll slide in a political comment that I know they're going to just say something that's absolutely infuriating, just so I can be like, yeah, see, this is how they are. This is how you are, you know? And I think we, like you said, we do this in so many different ways with many different relationships, but oh man, it is fun.
I love that honesty. That's so cool. Our parents are amazing, amazing vessels for us to really learn about ourselves.
Oh yeah. Changing gears a little bit. How does someone know in the context of their career, of their work, when it's time to move on and when you just need to muster the patience to keep going?
Wow. Well, I think my first blush take on that would be, this might sound repetitive, like I can't answer that question.
Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah. You can answer that question. And for me, what it typically happens in my experience is that many of us have become extremely logical. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. We've become very rational and logical. And many of us have lost sight of the language of our heart, and maybe the language of sensation and the language of sensation and feeling. And for me, any decision, I am really allowing myself to feel it, the immediate response, the initial kind of gut instinct or intuitive instinct, if you want to call it that. I'm allowing myself to feel that rather than think about it. And I'll use myself as an example again. You know, I'm here in Denmark. 2 months ago, I came here to teach a retreat. I got off the plane. I was walking around directly after getting off the plane, and I thought a very weird thought. The thought was, I feel at home. In that moment, I decided I was going to move. And that was based purely on a feeling and a draw. Now, as soon as I made that decision, all this rationalization came in. How are you going to do this? How are you going to make money? How's this going to work out? What about your car? All of the stories that I create to keep me where I'm at or where I was at. I want to be clear. If I stayed where I was at, I don't think that's bad either. I'm just simply saying that I was following a feeling. And so for this person, my first question to her is, how do you feel? What do you sense when you're doing what you're doing currently? What does that job represent to you? You know, we go back to this idea about coffee. I wanted to give a vibrant expression of what coffee represents to me so that hopefully if we got to this point, we could ask things in a different way. If us as human beings would start to ask questions outside of the literal realm being you're sitting, you're standing, this is a desk in front of you, I walk on the ground, earth, blah, blah, blah. Very literal. Any challenge that you have in your life, it can be very helpful to get yourself out of the literal realm. What does that mean? The next realm, from my perspective, would be into the metaphor or into the symbolic realm. Okay, what does this job represent to me? What do I feel like in this job? What does it remind me of? What does it remind me of from the past? How old do I feel when I go to work? What's my relationship with myself about my bosses or my coworkers? If we can start to open up the vibrancy of symbolism, paradox, and creativity, i.e., you are the creator of your reality. And what I mean by that is you literally create how you experience anything. I am a coach, and you know, I teach for some places that teach coaching. And if I had a nickel for every person that told me they wanted to be a coach because they thought it was going to be a better job, I'd be a rich coach. The trick to that is that the ego is extremely, or your ego parts are extremely relative. So it really doesn't literally matter what you're doing. Whatever you go and do next, you may potentially create the same exact stories of what you're creating around the current job that you have. So my work with clients, or my question to this person, is to peel back the layers. Peel back the layers in terms of, why is this feeling tense to me. What is going on here? What's going on underneath the story? My experience of human beings is that we are masters of deception of self. And typically, most of the first stories that come out of our mouths are typically deflective stories that are deflecting from what's really going on beneath the surface. So we create these stories so that we can hide and not learn about how we deceive ourselves. If we learn how we start to deceive ourselves, then we can become more clear on what's going on internally, and we can start to change our perceptions. As we start to change our perceptions, that job that feels like a pain in the ass right now, or that I want to change, or I'm not into, may actually become an amazing gift. One of the issues that I see in our world, you know, the spiritual world, the emotional world, is my perspective is that there's a lot of bypassing going on. So we have this very high level view of, maybe it's high level view. Everything is as it should be. Yeah. Everything has a purpose. What can I learn from this? Mm-hmm. Yada, yada. Beautiful. I love it. I love that perspective. I think it's necessary. But to get from, I feel like crap at work, and just switch it to, my work is purposeful, is bypassing a tremendous amount of emotion and feeling, and it's actually discounting and not acknowledging your own inner children or your own inner pieces that need to be acknowledged and heard for us to move together forward. As long as you turn your back on your inner world by denying what's going on from a feeling and emotional perspective, you will continue to repeat the same patterns that you have in the past. A very simple way to look at this is, if you want to know your future, I know this sounds very cliche, look to your past. Where it doesn't become cliche is, your future will repeat your past without conscious intervention. Unless you start to look at, how am I benefiting from these patterns? What are my emotional patterns? What's my way of navigating life? Why do I act the way that I do in relationships, in friendships, in jobs, at the grocery store? As you become more aware of why you're doing what you're doing, you can become more aware of, what part of me is looking for my attention now? What part of me is looking for the real parent to come? I.e., I'm 41 years old. So what part of me is looking for my own attention and crying out through these, in quote, dysfunctional behaviors or being in jobs that I don't like, etc., trying to get my attention so that we can integrate and work together eventually to go through a change process if that feels synergistic to the whole. Many of us, I think, speak in a language of, I don't like my job, or I don't like riding a bike, or I this or I that. And in the decision-making process, it's really helpful to use a different language. And maybe it's a language of acknowledgement. And that language of acknowledgement for me is, a part of me. A part of me doesn't like this job. Another part of me knows I find a lot of safety and security in this job, and I like that. Another part of me wants to leave this job. Another part of me is curious about why I want to leave this job. It starts to open up our emotional vibrancy, and it starts to give acknowledgement to that we have many aspects of self. And if we can start to acknowledge those many aspects, they start to feel heard, just like little kids. What does a little kid need? They need acknowledgement. They need attention. And as long as your little children internally are not getting that, they will continue to yell, scream, kick, fight, punch to get your attention.
That makes sense. One thing that stood out to me a little bit was you said that your future self, your future will repeat your past without conscious intervention. And I think that's really huge, especially for people in our industry and people in general who are very connected to spirit, who feel, who resonate with this kind of a lifestyle, is that it drives me nuts. I mean, it almost, I roll my eyes so far back. I think, you know, they might not ever come back to the front. Whenever I hear like, well, whatever is meant to be will be, we'll just see what happens. Like, if it's meant to happen, it'll happen. And I'm kind of like, I mean, kind of, but you also have to really actively participate and take action. And so I think that the importance of taking making a conscious intervention is a really key, like, highlight that if you're taking notes. And as someone who also quit a job that they hated, I worked in finance for a few years after college, and I was absolutely miserable, but I was making good money and I felt secure and blah, 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 401k, yada, yada. One of the things that helped me kind of decide if I was making the right call to leave was also asking myself, you know, am I running from something? Am I running from this commitment? Am I running from just being a quote unquote adult? And I think that might be worth asking yourself as well, because I know my sister, who's 5 years younger than I am, she and all of her friends are kind of in a similar situation in life where they're just starting to get real jobs and they don't like any of them, no matter what the job is. Like, they hate them, and they go to something else and they hate that, and they go to something else and they hate that. And it's kind of, you have to ask yourself what it is that you're really hating, what it is that's rubbing you the wrong way. And yeah, I think that's a tough question to answer as well. What is it about this thing that I hate so much that's draining my energy?
Yeah, I love that perspective. A question that I ask myself quite frequently is, do I feel like this situation is expanding me or contracting me? And that's been kind of my guide. And not to say that contraction's bad. I think contraction's purposeful as well. But I definitely use it as part of, like, do I feel expanded? Do I feel open? Do I feel like, this might sound a little fun. Do I feel like my heart and my mind are in synergy with each other? Mm-hmm. I think that's important. I think feeling that and thinking that and allowing both of those capacities. And if you notice that you're a very typically a thinker, maybe a way to balance yourself out is to invite more feelings in. More emotion, more sensation. And if you notice that typically you're a feeler, sensing, and emotional, then maybe a way to balance yourself out is to bring more thinking in. And for me, it's, can you look at yourself, ask, where am I feeling and thinking I'm out of balance, and how do I balance that, and then start to make decisions from that place with this peeling back the layers too, because ultimately said from my perspective, which a lot of my ego part still disagree with, but a larger part is growing. So I want to give voice to that, is I actually do not think it's possible to make a mistake. I don't think it's possible to make a mistake. I don't think it's possible to make the wrong decision. I don't think that's actually possible. For me, what happens is our egos create a value structure around the outcomes or the expectations of things. And then we decide, well, that was a mistake or a bad decision. But acknowledging how you're feeling, you know, me just coming on this podcast before getting on, before I teach or before I speak, there's a part of me that becomes scared and nervous. And am I going to be enough? Are people going to like me? Am I going to say the right or wrong things? Mm-hmm. And before I do all of that, I allow myself to notice, that's my 5-year-old. And I let him know that he's okay and that his feelings are valid and that 41-year-old Jatour is here to protect him, to inspire him, to validate him, and most importantly, probably to acknowledge him. And then him and I get to work together. And I've found that my fear and my nervousness and my sense of, am I not enough or am I enough? And this little boy that resides in me quite frequently, this 5-year-old, he's actually become my superpower. Him and I working together creates a much more synergistic feeling between us both, because he feels safe and acknowledged and protected. And he knows that the 41-year-old isn't going to let anything happen to him ever again.
I like that visual. I think that's a good exercise to do mentally when we get into that space of not enough. But I have to go back to something you said a minute ago. I mean, I hit the brakes. I got to turn around. You said you don't think it's possible to make a mistake. And that sort of just, I don't know how to process that, because I'm going to be vague and in a personal example. But like, there was a time early in my business where I had the opportunity to, I could have gone very fast, in a very short amount of time, had I applied myself. And I was in a chapter in my life where I did not have the work ethic I have today. And I let a lot of opportunity slide. And I could have been at a very different place right now had I taken advantage of that. To me, I don't hold that against myself today as like a, oh, I'm so bad. Oh, I should have. It's not something I actively feel guilty about, but it is something that I have checked off in my head as that was a mistake. You learned a lesson. You're never going to do that again. And so I feel like, I mean, of course there are mistakes we can make that are life altering, in a bad way. So, I mean, not being able to make a mistake, how do you just explain?
Oh man, I love it. Okay. So, from my perspective, there's a couple things that you shared that come up for me immediately. The language, I'm really into language. Mm-hmm. So the language of making a mistake is essentially saying, I feel a sense of, you said it, guilt. I feel a sense of guilt, shame, or fear about a decision. Mm-hmm. So that's one piece. The mistake, using the language of a mistake, immediately puts us into a place of fear and shame. You also said, if I was who I am today and I made this decision, then I would be at a very different point in my life now. My kind of counter to that is, would you be? You have no idea what place you'd be in right now if you had made that decision. In fact, I'd say it's pretty interesting that this, in quotes, mistake led you in part and challenged you in part for you to be exactly where you are today. My perspective is that everyone is exactly where they need to be at exactly every moment. And part of this perspective of not being able to make a mistake is this. I think that there is something at work here that is beyond the mind of a human being. Mm-hmm. And because of that, I think and feel, for me, at least most of me, again, parts of me agree with you, and it's very hard. There is some conflict still around this. Mm-hmm. That the idea then is you can't do it wrong. What you can do is create that you did it wrong so that you can feel a sense of shame and fear about what you would have been rather than what you are. And many of us are taught as children that it doesn't matter who we are, it matters what we do. So some of the things you said in your spiel, which I appreciate and acknowledge, it was like, well, I would have been all of these things. And, you know, I'm guessing there's monetary things and, you know, success and whatever that means to you. Those are all your value sets. And any decision that we make is going to come with outcomes. Those outcomes are not up to you or me. We have attachments and expectation to those outcomes. But how many times in your life have you done something and the outcome was the polar opposite of what you thought it would be? What am I really saying? I'm saying is human beings own the illusion of control. And we all have control dramas. And we all do things out of a sense of trying to create control in our lives. This is why familiarity is so hard to get out of, i.e. I'm in a dysfunctional relationship where I get beat, man or woman. One of the reasons why that's really hard to get out of is because we actually gain a sense of control by being in that relationship because it's very familiar to our emotional needs. It feels comfortable. And to leave it is actually scarier than to stay in it. At least I know what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. I'm in control. To leave that situation, someone might say, is a good decision. I might just say, it's a decision. I don't know what the outcome is going to be. But you have already created a story for yourself, which is, if I would have made this decision a long time ago, I would be in a different place than I am now. Mm-hmm. My question is that true?
Oh, I totally 100% agree with you and see your point. I mean, yeah, it's a completely made up story. We all do this. Like, oh yeah, if I'd done this thing, wow, so much would have been different. So yeah, I mean, it's a story and I could be completely wrong. Yeah, I mean, but then I also think that maybe not shame, but certainly guilt has a place in our life to help guide us, I think. Not that we should feel guilty all the time for everything, but I think it serves a purpose for me personally. as my vice is being a sloth. I mean, I could just sloth around and watch Netflix all day and pretty much be okay with that. But I have to make a conscious decision not to. And in part, I do that because I have purpose, but I also am like, I'm running from that feeling of guilt. So in that way, I do feel like guilt can be somewhat productive. Or am I wrong?
No, I love that. My license plate says Sloth 23.
Oh, my God.
Very fast car, which is super fun. So I love that you said sloth. I think it's really important that I say this, and I'll say it. I think I said it once or twice already. I don't think anything is wrong or right. So I think everything has a light and a shadow side to it. Guilt has a light and a shadow side. Shame has a light and shadow side. Joy has a light and shadow side. Being a sloth has a light and shadow side. What I heard you say is, my guess is, I feel a sense of guilt and or shame about being a sloth because of the family values that I learned as a child. Cool. And you push yourself using guilt. Cool. No issue there. My only thing is bringing up, can we notice that we're doing that to ourselves? And can we notice that many of us have an addiction to guilt, shame, and fear? And part of that addiction is the language of, I made a mistake. I did something wrong. Based on whose values is my question. Mm. Your parents' values? Or your new value set that you've learned to create for yourself? Because typically, if we haven't dove into where our values come from, that guilt and or shame is coming from the values that we learned as children and who we thought we needed to be for our parents. As an example, I love being a sloth too. I don't feel a sense of guilt about it. And what's really interesting, you look at my childhood, I gave voice to my mom and my experience with my mom, mm-hmm. struggling, single mom and tight on money. Even in that situation, maybe about once every month and a half, 2 months, my mom would come into my room, wake me up and say, hey, Ja, you want to play hooky today? And I'd say, well, hell yeah.
Yeah.
And so my mom, even when she was tight on money, struggling, made sure that I knew that play and time off was important. So for me, I don't feel a sense of guilt about the sloth. I feel a sense of, this is what is part of my balancing act. This is how I can go and do all of these things that I want to do and use my sloth for recovery and slow time and Netflix and enjoy that with a joyous boyhood smile rather than being a sloth and feeling a sense of guilt the whole time I'm being a sloth.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be something like if you were my client, we would dive into, well, what part of you feels guilty about being a sloth? And we start to dive into the underpinnings of that, not to change it,
mm-hmm.
only to become more aware of why you're using guilt and or shame and or fear to motivate yourself. Can we use other things? Can we use courage to motivate ourselves? My experience is that many of us as human beings have a very high addiction to guilt, shame, and fear. And when you look at a lot of the, in quotes, mistakes that we make, many of us purposefully make mistakes so we can feel a sense of guilt, shame, or fear.
I feel like this conversation could just be never ending. So I am going to say, I'm locking myself into asking you two final questions.
Cool.
And the first one is, can you share one, might take a little bit of thought, but can you share one thing that you get asked about the most? Maybe something that you feel like we all have in common.
Dear Jator, how do I get out of my funk?
Yes.
Oh, man. I think that's a common theme. Outside of all the things that we've shared about so far, I think are a lot of ways out of that funk. Something from my perspective that I think is quite often overlooked, or maybe not even considered, back to this idea of guilt and shame and fear,
mm-hmm.
is that if you're in a funk, one of the most powerful ways to move into it, I'm using a very different language here, not through it, not past it, move into it, is to allow yourself to fully feel your funk. Not to change it, not to make it better, not to hide from it, maybe not to Netflix, maybe not to meditate, maybe not to garden, maybe sit somewhere and allow yourself to really feel your feelings and feel your emotions and feel your funk. What's really interesting about that from my perspective is that many of us have been taught that the way to move past things is to move past them. My perspective is different. My perspective is to move into them, is to acknowledge them. If you're feeling funky, it means that a part of you is feeling funky. And that part of you is knocking on the bedroom door, your bedroom door, saying, I need your attention. I need your acknowledgement. I need to be seen. If we close that door, keep that door closed, that knocking will continue to get louder and louder in different ways in our lives. It's a paradox. You're gonna get uncomfortable. You're gonna feel feelings you don't wanna feel. You're gonna cry. You're gonna throw up. You're gonna heave. And that's all necessary and beautiful. Where did we each learn that negative emotions, and I'm doing air quotes right now, are negative? What if I said that the in quotes negative emotions are just as beautiful, just as powerful, just as necessary, just as life affirming as the ones that we deem positive? What if we ask the question, who taught us what are negative and positive emotions? How many times were we celebrated for crying? How many times were we celebrated and acknowledged for feeling out of control or getting angry? How many of us were celebrated or even acknowledged for that? Or were you told, don't act like that? What if it's okay that you're in a funk? What if it's okay that you're angry? What if it's okay that you feel a sense of rage? What if it's okay that you feel a sense of fear and shame and guilt? And where is that coming from? And who inside of me is looking for my attention? On my hands, I have two tattoos. Well, actually, I have a lot of tattoos, but two new recent ones that are on my hands, left and right hand, facing me in big letters. One hand says be, the other hand says kind. And they're facing me, not the outside world. And I think one of the most profound teachings I have ever been witness to was very, very simple. And it came from a friend of mine who I have a lot of respect for. And we were texting back and forth, and I was beating myself up for making a mistake. She sent me back this text: would you be willing to be kind to my friend? What if we all learn to start to be kind to ourselves no matter what we're feeling? What if we learn to acknowledge that and notice how when we're feeling a certain way, we are actually very unkind to ourselves and beat ourselves up or tell us ourselves to wear a mask or tell ourselves to hide or tell ourselves to get in our own picture and put a smile on our face because that's what we learned when we were kids? What if that's a way out of funk authentically, to get to a place where funk's okay, smile's okay, and I'm going to be real about who I am today?
And that's a perfect last note, I feel. But I did have one final question that I promised I would ask. So the last question was, how do you respond to people who make light of or dismiss your work as a life coach?
Ooh, I love that. How do I respond? I respond typically in this way. That's okay. I make light of myself. And the dismissing part is really interesting. I don't think anyone can dismiss me. So from my perspective, everyone's opinion is legitimate. And if your opinion is life coaches are crap, or I'm crap, I'm okay with that. If your opinion is life coaches are great or you're great, I'm okay with that too. What I hear people sharing when they're projecting onto me is I'm hearing their value sets. I'm hearing their lenses. I'm hearing their perspective. And I'm okay with people having perspectives that are different than mine. Even if it's about me. And in fact, what's cool about that is if I get triggered around someone saying, you know, dismissing my work or dismissing me as a coach or other life coaches, it's a moment for me to get really curious. Whoa, what is coming up in me right now? Why is this triggering to me? Why is this causing an emotional charge? Is this person responsible for how I feel? My answer is no. This person isn't responsible. This person is allowed to have their opinion and perspective. And some of that comes to this word I think we've used a couple times here today, which is respect. I don't want friendships or partnerships out of loyalty. I want them out of respect. And what respect means for me is a little different. It means that I'm okay if your perspective is different than mine and we can still be friends. And for me, loyalty is typically obligation to a relationship out of fear, because I'm learning still, and will continue to learn, that it's not my job to prove and defend what I do to anyone. It's my job to be synergistic with myself about what I do. And I feel very comfortable in what I do. And I feel purposeful in what I do. And I love people's honesty. I love when people are blatantly honest with me. I would rather hear your honest truth than politically correct BS, quite frankly.
Oh, totally. 100% agree. I love that answer. Thank you so much. I think we're totally a match made in podcast heaven. Thanks again.
Okay. What did you think? First, I've got to know, how many times did you find yourself rolling your eyes, but then simultaneously nodding along like it was kind of actually making sense? I definitely felt that way at times, but more often than not, I was just listening and agreeing. I think there's something to having a life coach for the exact reasons Chatur mentioned. They're completely unattached to you emotionally and can be an unbiased source of direction and advice. So now I'm very curious to hear what your personal takeaways were from this episode. One thing that personally stayed with me was this exercise in asking yourself how you change for other people. Whether it's parents coming over or even friends or colleagues, in what ways do you hide your true self to accommodate other people's opinions or feelings? That one really sank in, and I'll definitely be thinking about that one for a long time. Now, as usual, I'd love to hear from you. Don't be shy in sharing your own personal takeaways with me and Chatur on social media. Find Chatur on Instagram at explorewithchatur. So that's explore with Chatur, Jator. Explore with Chatur on Instagram or on YouTube at youtube.com/explorewithchatur. You can also book a digital session with him on his website, which is slightly different here. It's www.wehlc.com. I'm going to link to all of this in the show notes. So if you're like, wait, go back. Don't worry about it. You can just click in the description below this episode. All right, thank you so much for joining me today. I really hope you found this episode helpful. If you liked this episode or literally any other episode I've ever done, please go over to iTunes, leave us a review and a rating. It seriously goes such a long way in helping other people discover the podcast. So yeah, I think that's all for me today. Thank you so much again for joining me. I hope you have a great rest of your day, and I'll see you right back here next time.